Welcome once again to our series, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We're talking about the novel that so many millions of people read, and that's coming out now in DVD, and also some games based on following the Da Vinci Code type of clue thing. My guest again is Ron Eldred, who is a teacher at John Paul II Catholic High in History, Religion, and Government. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church in 19th and Poplar, here in terrific Terre Haute. Ron, welcome once again. We're on our sixth series when we've been talking about the Da Vinci Code, and we're trying to point out why so many Catholics and Protestants were very upset about the whole presentation in the Da Vinci Code, because it seemed to rewrite history, and it seemed to question the very fundamentals of the Christian faith. We got up to that point where we were talking about the Da Vinci Code, the novel, of course, but by its presentation and statements in the novel, propagates a relativistic, indifferent attitude toward truth and religion. I think you were quoting Olson and Meisel, who wrote that rather well-known book, The Vinci Hoax.
Yes.
Okay, because there were several books. And so you were kind of quoting some of their research about why relativism is so breathed in the atmosphere of reading the novel.
Let me preface that with just a few comments to get our listeners back into the context of the discussion. You gave some of it there. We've been talking about what's wrong with the Da Vinci Code, which you suggested there. And then Olson and Meisel find five major objections with the book. And the first one was, it claims to be historically accurate and based on fact, but often is not. Well, we looked at two or three little examples of that, and then, but later on we're going to be getting into dozens of examples of that. Then number two, it repeatedly misunderstands or misrepresents people, places, and events. It especially rewrites and misrepresents church and secular history. Well, then we gave a few examples of that. And then number three, it promotes a radical feminist neo-Gnostic agenda. We gave a little bit of information on that, but later on we'll be spending about five or six sessions on that subject. Number four, it propagates a relativistic, indifferent attitude toward truth and religion. And that's the one we got started on, but we ran out of time and we feel like it's too important to gloss over too much, so we're going to come back and discuss that one a little bit more. And then the last one was, it incorrectly and unfairly misrepresents Christianity and traditional Christian beliefs about God, Jesus, and the Bible. And that's the one we're going to spend the most time on.
Okay, because that's the heart of where the Da Vinci Code novel is blowing up the traditional constant belief about God, about Jesus, and the Bible. And that's one of the reasons we're doing this series, particularly now that the DVDs are coming out at this time.
Well, let me come back then to your question there, Olson and Meisel. What do they mean when they say the Da Vinci Code propagates a relativistic, indifferent attitude towards truth and religion? And as I mentioned a little bit in our last session, one of the great dangers of a popular entertaining work such as the Da Vinci Code is that it reinforces the relativistic attitudes that are so prevalent in our society. In fact, Western culture in general, and U.S. society in particular. And it because it offers additional reasons for readers to embrace such attitudes. Relativism is the view that truth is relative and may vary from individual to individual, from group to group, or from time to time, or from place to place. The truth has no objective standard. An example is what we call cultural relativism, which claims that different cultures have different but perfectly legitimate and equally valid standards of truth and value. Relativism is often just another word for subjectivism. They always go together.
Subjectivism, meaning I, the subject, determine what is true.
Yes, it's an ideology or a philosophy that holds that the only valid standard of judgment is that of the individual. And, for example, ethical subjectivism. It holds that individual conscience is the only appropriate standard for moral judgment. And those holding this view believe that there exists no objective standards of right or wrong outside of the individual's mind. And truth is believed to be nothing more than the opinion or the opinions of individuals. Pope Benedict believes our biggest enemy is moral relativism, the belief that there exists no objective moral standards or no absolutes, and that something is right or wrong depending upon time, place, circumstance, situation, relativism or relevance, consequence, and context. In fact, there's actually a philosophical view related to every one of those. For example, you take situation, there's situation ethics. You take consequence, there's consequentialism. You take context, there's contextualism. These are all different views that deal with the truth simply being relative rather than absolute.
I remember first when that situation ethics came up many years ago, they quoted and I went to a series of lectures about it, but the professor was all in favor of situation ethics, means that a situation like adultery, and that's what he was quoting, could be right or wrong depending on the circumstance. And the circumstance was that this person was going to commit adultery with somebody else's, have sexual relations with somebody else's wife, because he wanted to give her a good self-image and to help her with her bad self-image. And so he was doing this as an act of love for the other person, and so therefore it was okay in this circumstance. And that's very subtle, you know, that I'm acting as a loving person, so that makes it a loving act. Well, what about his own wife? What about the husband of the other guy? So it's that type of thing, that the circumstance in which I'm doing something, and I heard that argued by other people. Yeah, well, I think that'd be okay in that circumstance. So it's a high-powered, destructive force that is propagated under very innocent and high-sounding moral or ethical terms.
Back in the 70s, the biggest name in that whole
situation ethics
was Joseph Fletcher.
That's the name.
And he wrote a number of books. I read quite a bit of that literature back in those days. I was teaching at a college at that time. And yes, for the sake of love, that was his main theme.
As long as it's
yes.
A loving act.
And of course, their definition of love is certainly not a Christian definition of love.
Right.
And that was all a part of, you know, secular humanism. And the biggest, if I recall right, the biggest critic of that whole thing at the time was a man by the name of Paul Ramsey. He was a Protestant minister.
But he was a Protestant theologian.
Yes, he was a theologian. He wasn't just an ordinary minister.
Yeah.
He was a professor type.
And quite well respected.
Oh, yes, yes. Even by Catholic
right.
theologians, highly respected Paul Ramsey.
Okay. Well, I think James Hitchcock has some things to say that's pertinent to this relativism found in the Da Vinci Code.
Yes. Olson and Meisel, they quote James Hitchcock. He's a prominent Catholic professor of history at St. Louis University. In fact, his wife also is a very, very capable, scholarly person. Helen Hitchcock's her name. Helen
really?
Hull Hitchcock.
Okay.
In fact, she has an organization that has to do with Adoramus.
Oh.
A website, and has to do with liturgy, trying to do to improve the liturgy in the church. And she's written books, and they have even a hymnal. It's called the Adoramus Hymnal. And then also there's an organization, Faith and Family, I think is the name of it. She's also, I think, the president of that.
Okay, and that's his wife?
That's his wife,
James,
yes.
Hitchcock's wife. Heard much about James Hitchcock and the professor at St. Louis. He defended John Paul Paul II, I thought, magnificently against many of his critics.
Well, to quote him, Olson and Meisel are quoting him, quote, millions of people read the Da Vinci Code not because they necessarily believe its absurd story, but because it creates a myth that serves certain emotional needs and allows them to be religious without submitting to any of the demands of faith, end of quote. And reacting to Professor Hitchcock's comment, Olson and Meisel make reference to remarks made by Robert Langdon. You know, he's the hero of the book. The Da Vinci Code,
right?
Quote, who talks about faith as being built upon fabrication and beliefs that cannot be proven in any way.
And that's his understanding of faith.
That's his
that there's no basis for it, and there's no reason to believe. And we spent that whole section on reasons to believe, although faith and reason are different gifts that God has given us. Okay. Well, why do you think such ideas are appealing to society and people in our cultures, even world culture?
Toward the end of the series, we're going to spend at least a session on this topic. But for now, Olson and Meisel, they state, quote, it frees people from any sense of obligation or discipline, and it allows them to perceive reality, in whichever way best suits their desires. Unfortunately, many Christians who are fans of the novel do not seem to appreciate that it is an attack upon the core beliefs of the Christian faith, end of quote. Then they go on to quote Professor Hitchcock again as saying, quote, the Da Vinci Code is not merely another liberal revision. It is nothing less than the claim that Christianity has been a deliberate fraud almost from its beginning, that the true story of Jesus was suppressed, and that only now are we finally learning what it was all about, end of quote. And then Olson and Meisel wrap up their treatment of relativism generated by the Da Vinci Code by saying, quote, the lack of awareness of the novel's assaults on history, fact, and logic is evident. It is evidence of a deep erosion of basic thinking and studying skills, as well as the ambivalent attitude towards truth of each of these, end of quote.
Well, those are really powerful statements, and I think that's one of the best statements I've heard, that it's even, I've talked to many people who like the novel, and because it was a mystery thriller, you know. But here's what he says. Many people do not appreciate it's an attack upon the core beliefs, the basic fundamentals of our faith.
Either one or two things. They don't know the faith well enough to know it's being attacked, or they know the faith well enough and they like what they hear. They like to hear the faith being attacked. Other than that, I don't see how anybody could be indifferent.
Well, I think a person could say, oh, well, it's just a novel, and it doesn't bother me. And that's the old approach, that I can read anything, I can watch any kind of movies, I can associate with any kind of people, and it's not going to affect me. But I think that's oblivious of the fact, to put it in a simple way, tell me with whom you go, tell me what you read, and that birds of a feather flock together, that we are greatly afflicted, but affected. I think psychologists say we're something like 80 or 85% affected by the people that we associate with and the things that we read or the movies that we watch. They do have a profound effect upon us. And I think anybody who gets into pornography would testify with their hand on the Bible in court that this becomes something that I can no longer control. It's become a real addiction. So what we read and people we associate with have a profound effect, and that's why I think it's so dangerous, the Da Vinci Code, because it is a pleasant novel to read for so many people.
One could even call it a near occasion of sin or a...
I think really it could be
a sin against faith,
because it's certainly, because he presents all this stuff as historical facts, and it's bound to raise questions in my mind, even in a well-educated person. Okay, well, let's go on. What do you think Olson and Meisel mean when they say the Da Vinci Code incorrectly and unfairly misrepresents Christianity and traditional Christian beliefs about the core of the matter, God, Jesus, and the Bible?
Well, I think this is the area that Dan Brown is most in error. And to mention only a few of his unfounded claims, he claims that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married and had a child. That prior to 325 AD, no one believed Jesus was divine. That Emperor Constantine declared Jesus to be God. That Constantine rejected dozens of other gospels and rewrote the four that are in the Christian Bible. That the Catholic Church burned over 5 million witches. I've heard in another place, 9 million.
Okay.
And that the leaders of the Catholic Church continue to keep the truth about Jesus from the masses through lies, deception, intimidation, and violence. The Da Vinci Code is full of these and many other false claims about Jesus, the Bible, and the Catholic Church. As Olson and Meisel tell us, few scholars take any of Brown's claims seriously. But many readers simply don't have the background or the time or the inclination to find out the truth. They say that even worse, many readers accept Brown's claims without consulting an encyclopedia or any other resources to verify the truth of his claims, apparently believing that if it's in print, it's got to be true. Now, worse yet, perhaps, they want to... what he says to be true. Some people want what he says to be true.
Okay, now who's saying this? Oh, Olson and Meisel.
Yes.
Okay. That means there's a great attraction to what is being said, that Jesus isn't God and that the Catholic Church has suppressed the truth and that Constantine really was the one who selected the four Gospels and threw the other authentic gospels out, etc., etc.
And we're going to refute every one of those.
Okay.
And now, continuing with the quote, it could be that truth is not a concern to them. And they conclude by saying, quote, regardless, the misrepresentation of Christian beliefs in the novel is so aggressive and continual, that we can only conclude that it is a result of willful ignorance or purposeful malice, end of quote. And reading the novel, it's just almost continuous all the way through it.
An attack, attack, yes. Attack. Okay. Since Olson and Meisel claim that the Da Vinci Code incorrectly and unfairly represents Christianity and the traditional Christian beliefs about God and Jesus in the Bible, maybe we can spend some time in this series analyzing this one.
Yeah, we'll spend the rest of the series actually looking at this, the fifth overall criticism that Olson and Meisel found in the Da Vinci Code, because that's where you find the doctrinal the doctrine.
There's where the great attacks.
Yes, there's where the great attacks
are. All right, since we have some time, let's tackle that. How does the Da Vinci Code incorrectly and unfairly misrepresent Christianity in this 2,000-year history and traditional Christian beliefs about God and Jesus and the Bible?
Well, there are several areas. One, and these are ones that were identified by Olson and Meisel, I might add. But all of the various critics, Shree and Shea and Amy Wellborn and Jenkins and Davis and several others, of course, deal with the same topics.
In preparation, besides for this program, besides reading the novel itself, you read several critiques of these people who had really studied the historical background.
At least five or six of the main, most Catholic critics.
Okay.
Except for Jenkins. And Jenkins is not a Catholic. He's a professor at Pennsylvania State University in history.
Okay.
And But he's very interested in the Catholic Church. In fact, he wrote a book called The Last Acceptable Prejudice, subtitled Anti-Catholicism.
Really?
And
he's a Protestant himself?
He's a Protestant himself. But it's,
well, God bless him.
Really, very strong, powerful, historical, defense of the Catholic faith.
Okay.
At the church more than the teachings, you know,
sure.
As such, as an institution. Well, they give, Olson and Meisel have, five areas. And these are the ones we're going to focus on, and I'll list them right now. The first one is, Jesus Christ was not truly divine. This is a claim now of the Da Vinci Code. He was not truly divine, but merely a good man raised to a deity by the Emperor Constantine in 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea.
Okay, powerful misrepresentative of what Catholics have always believed.
Number two, Jesus Christ came not to save the world from sin, but to restore the sacred feminine.
Okay.
Number three, Jesus Christ was married to Mary Magdalene and had children. Number four, Jesus Christ appointed Mary Magdalene to head the Catholic Church instead of Peter.
Well, that's certainly a blow at the 264 popes who have sat in the chair of St. Peter, walked in the shoes of the big fisherman.
And then finally, the Catholic Church has kept these and other so-called facts hidden through force and intimidation over the centuries. So those are the five doctrinal, that deal with doctrinal issues of the Catholic Church. These things need to be
answered. Because they're really bombshells.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people believe them, and a lot of Catholics believe them. It's these five claims made by Dan Brown is why we are so concerned about the novel, the Da Vinci Code, because it really strikes at the very heart of the Catholic faith in particular and of Christianity in general.
Okay, well, and I'd like to add to that many times people say things like this. There's some of the things I've heard. Well, you shouldn't be talking about of the Da Vinci Code because it'll just give it more publicity and just to let it die a natural death. But I think the problem is it received so much publicity. How many millions of people read the book, the novel?
It was. I've seen claims as high as 60 million.
Okay, well, and that's
worldwide.
So it went around the world, and
translated into dozens of languages.
Translated, and one person told me they saw it even in a hardware store, set there to publicize it, and then of course. I was standing out in front of the Vatican Library on a recent visit to Rome, and we were in this 3-hour wait to get into the Sistine Chapel, and right maybe 5 feet away from me, two people were intensely discussing the Da Vinci Code. And one person was trying to say that it's not historically accurate, and the other person was very loudly defending, it is, it's the truth. So it's affected so many people's thinking. And now with the DVD coming out, with a game based on the Da Vinci Code coming out, and the I guess the movie wasn't that popular, really, but the book certainly sold endless amount. And how many people, even Catholic people, said, oh, it's a fun novel to read, and that's all it is. I didn't pay any attention to it. I know that stuff isn't true. But an awful lot of people who would read that novel would not know that it's false. And these five claims that the book makes in the novel, Jesus isn't God, well, that's the heart of the Christian faith. It's the bullseye of everything we believe. It's the heart of the creed. So if he's just a good man, then we're out of business as the Catholic Church, or Christianity, at least from as I understand Christianity, is out of business. Did you hear many people say it wasn't that influence of them, or didn't bother them that much, or really wasn't?
Well, I've heard people say that something similar to what you said a while ago. Well, it's dying down, and this, that, and the other. But yet, on the other hand, I don't think it was ever probably answered as well as it should have been. Yeah, it was in some of the books, but how many people read the books?
Right. And EWTN ran some series on it trying to...
And how many people watched that?
Right.
And so I think the more that you can put out, refutations of it in whatever media, you just reach that many more people. And even people that listen to, let's say, our series, they may not have read it or have the intention of reading, or perhaps they have. But at least now they'll know that all this stuff is, there are answers to it. And they could use that information in refuting it with other people that they know.
Sure.
Or at least telling them, here's the facts.
Right. I'm glad we're doing the series. And I'm glad you worked so hard on it, Ron, because I know you spent a long, long time even trying to digest it and put it in perhaps a language that would be intelligible without going into a lot of details, historical details.
Fortunately, of course, history was my major, and I taught history at the college level for quite a few years, 15 years altogether, and then taught high school. And teach high school now, and I teach these subjects, and so I keep up on these these things quite a bit. And when I heard about it, I could see that this very quickly that these claims that Dan Brown was making, I already knew the answers to most of it. I didn't have to do a lot of research there about Constantine and the Council of Nicaea. We talk about any of my students, John Paul II Catholic High students, would know immediately from reading the book what was wrong here, there, and everywhere else, or viewing the movie or the video.
But most people, even Catholic people, would not know enough of true factual Catholic history to be able to point out those five major issues that the novel attacks so violently.
Well, and unfortunately, I think in the last 30, 35 years, a lot of Catholics have not been very well educated, catechized in the faith, so they're really not they don't even know sometimes whether or not something's being criticized.
Well, we're going to talk in the next round about Jesus being divine, not just a good man. So I think our time has run out on us, and we'd like to thank our listeners for staying with us. Hope you'll be back for the seventh series on the Da Vinci Code. And may God bless you always and in all ways.